Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting individual, Graham Black. He's got over 25 years experience in the design industry, specializing in art directing editorial publications for some of the biggest and most respected brands in publishing, including the Financial Times, The Economist, and The Observer. Previously, his agency experience focused on the music industry, designing record sleeves, advertising and marketing campaigns for the likes of Virgin, EMI, Sony, and the Mercury Music Prize, amongst others. With a strong track record in both launching and redesigning magazines and newspapers, he also oversees the extension of brands through special supplements and one-off promotions. Most recently, this has included migrating print publications into new digital incarnations for the web and mobile devices. Particular areas of interest are in the arts, culture, sport, literature, and current affairs. His design approach is to employ powerful, sophisticated, and striking typography, photography, and illustration that reflect the brand values of a publication or organization and its position in the marketplace. Finally, after many years of commissioning, he's built up a contact book that includes many of the finest reportage, portrait, fashion, and travel photographers in the world, as well as the most innovative and well-known illustrators. So, that sounds fantastic. Graham, hi, Ender. How are you?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, crikey. You've made me sound very grand indeed. Yeah, I'm very well, actually. But that sounds like a kind of a description of a life from long ago, actually, from down in deepest, darkest Cornwall, where I am now. So, that was quite interesting to hear that.
Very good. Well, in terms of sort of life from long ago, and we'll talk about deepest, darkest Cornwall in a while, but so in terms of a life long ago, I do remember, just so everyone knows, I actually first met Graham years ago when we both worked in the tragic world of agencies. And I have to remember, Graham at that point, he was sort of senior creative in the agency, and no one could ever find him until about lunchtime. I always wondered why, till I found out about once I was about 6 months into the agency, that we were based in Greek Street in Soho, just over Soho Square were Sony Records, one of our clients. And so Graham, it turned out, was always going there in the morning when he dragged himself up from Brighton to London. And you were sleeping on Kit Buckler's sofa. Kit Buckler, as in the guy that used to, that lived in a squat with Joe Strummer and looked after the Clash for many years. So yes, busted, Mr. Black. So very good. Happy days, has to be said.
There were also days where I'd kind of been out with friends clubbing in Brighton, hadn't actually made it home, and just came straight out of the Zap Club onto a train and came straight to London as well. Those were slightly sort of furry around the edges kind of days, but then that was, you know, that was the 80s in Soho, so we still managed to function in one way or another. I think it was
sort of drag our way through it. Just in terms of taking us back to sort of your college days and then how you got into the industry, you know, a lot of people are trying to get into the industry, having a real problem there. You know, there's a huge challenges now for particularly for graduates. So just to prove that it's not a smooth and, should we say, coherent sort of a path, perhaps just, yeah, take us through how you did it.
This is going to sound really bad. I mean, I get asked this by students at uni all the time, really. I mean, I was growing up in, you know, as you know, sort of late 70s, 80s, in Crawley, Newtown. You know, I was born in South London. My parents got moved out. And that was a deeply depressing place to be. I mean, basically my life, if you've ever seen Shane Meadows, you know, amazing series, This Is England. Basically, I was the blonde one in that. That was my life story, really. So sort of growing up, you know, in what was, you know, I first became aware of art college through music, I guess. Very early on, even when I was kind of 13, 76, weirdly, as a 13-year-old, I seemed to have a lot of triple gatefold albums by Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Yes and things. Not because of the music, just because I was obsessed with the graphics, with the illustration, you know, those big gatefolds, you know, by Roger Dean for Yes and stuff, you know. So, you know, I was very kind of visually aware and I loved drawing. I mean, I wasn't particularly, I found my old school reports the other day and they all said the same sort of thing, you know, kind of very creative, quite bright, must try harder, gets easily distracted, chats too much, messes around, you know, the usual stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I kind of slowly through music, obviously with the big punk explosion, you know, with everything that happened in 76, 77, you know, starting to buy singles, you know, by the Buzzcocks and, you know, the Pistols, you know, Jamie Reed's Collages and all of that real explosion of energy in the music, you know, visually in the clothes, the attitude, but also the record sleeves, you know, I mean, they really had a huge effect on me. And I kind of, you know, became aware of kind of visual arts and photography, excuse me, through that, really, through the record sleeves, you know, Barney Bubbles, through Malcolm Garrett and Linda Sterling for the Buzzcocks, you know, things like that. And gradually became aware of this place called Art College, which I had no idea about. None of my family had ever been to university or higher education of any kind. But I, you know, I started to hear about, you know, bands, you know, being formed at art colleges and stuff. So I became aware of this. And I thought, well, that sounds like the kind of place for me. I quite like the idea of just like university I had no interest in at all and didn't really want to do. But, you know, being able to sit around all day drawing and making pictures and playing with type and, you know, that kind of thing really, really sort of hit the spot with me. So that's what got me interested in art college initially. So, yeah, I think it was, I can't remember who it was. I think it was... Tony Parsons or someone, you know, in the 70s, called art colleges like the bohemia for the working classes. And I think that's true. I think that's a really good description, actually, the idea that working class kids could have an education, but an education that was not rooted in Oxbridge and all that kind of thing and Eton and, you know, big universities, especially if you were much more interested in sort of creative visual arts. So sadly, I think the bohemia had been largely sucked out of art college by the time I rocked up in Brighton for my degree. But I did have a very great year on a foundation course. So when I finished school, I did a year of foundation course in Horsham, where I met some brilliant tutors who really were. I mean, that was a much more inspirational year for me that year at college than the 3 years at my degree course level down in Brighton, if I'm honest. And they were great printmakers. They were great photographers. They were fun. They were irreverent. And they instilled in me a lifelong love of print as well, you know, which I've obviously, you know, will come to, but I've come back to. But so that's kind of how I got into art college. The way I'd sort of transferred out into the world of work. I was incredibly lucky, I guess. So this may not be a typical situation and it may not be of much use to sort of younger people right now. And I know my students get quite frustrated when they ask me, but I graduated from college. I'd had a friend of a friend who worked for a pop magazine called Record Mirror. And in between my second and third year, for the summer, I managed to get a bit of work experience with them. So when I graduated, I had half a thought that maybe I might like to get into that because it was a perfect fit with my love of music and, you know, record sleeves. I wanted to design record sleeves and had a passion for music. I was lying on a beach in a pair of shorts on Brighton seafront with my mates, you know, just drinking, chilling out, thinking I'd take the summer off. Should I go traveling? I thought, well, I had a phone number scribbled on a piece of paper of this guy at Record Mirror. So I thought, I left the beach, went to a red phone box, put my sort of 20p in the phone box, called him up. And this just shows you what a different age it was. There was no mobiles, no internet, no email, nothing like that, obviously. Mm. So I phoned him up and he said, good God, we've been trying to get hold of you for weeks. Our art director's left and gone to Smash Hits. We desperately need someone to design the magazine. Would you like to do it? And I said yes. I took the train up the next day, had an interview, and started work the day after that. So that was how long and how hard it was for me to get into the industry, which I suspect is not typical, and probably not something that you should rely on as a way of kind of working your way into the industry. But that was my foot in the door. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I had to wing it a lot. This was obviously pre-computers, pre-digital. It was all handmade. It was lick and stick. You know, there was loads of things I didn't know that I had to learn very, very quickly and learn on my feet. And it was very hands-on. But yeah, that's essentially what got me going, you know. And it was a brilliant, brilliant thing to do. I got free records. I went to free gigs. I went to photo shoots with bands, you know. LL Cool J, lots of rappers, lots of pop stars, Pet Shop Boys, The Clash, you know. So it was, it was a brilliant, brilliant and incredibly lucky break for me to get into the industry. So hands up, full transparency, it wasn't that much of a sweat for me, but that's pretty, pretty rare, I imagine.
yeah. Fantastic. And then just in terms of bringing us back up to date then, in terms of, so what exactly it is that you're doing now. So I'm just looking at your site. I mean, it's such a, I mean, it looks beautiful, has to be said, as it should do, obviously, for someone like you. But I mean, so everything on the Bowie on there, Orwell covers for Intelligent Life, Mandela, etc., all your fine art stuff. So yeah, just talk us through the practice and the different things that you're up to and have been doing.
Oh, well, okay. Well, since I guess we should establish that about 4 or 5 years ago, I kind of jumped ship, really. It was a bit of a life-changing experience for me, and it was quite scary. I mean, I didn't have a job to go to. I basically got burnt out, and I'd got sort of, my father had died after a long illness, and it was one of those things, you know, when you get a little bit longer in the tooth and you've been in the industry a long time, you start thinking, well, you know, what are the options? What can I end up doing? And for me, that was just jumping ship and buying an old cow shed in near Land's End in Cornwall to try and reconnect with my printmaking. I think having with the, you know, computers, technology, obviously, you know, there are tremendous benefits and I love using it and I love working with it. But one of the things that it had kind of taken away from me was a kind of physical process, a physicality in my design and art. You know, when I was at art college, it was all about ink and developing and, you know, just kind of really getting dirty and tearing paper. And it was quite a physical process, design. And computers kind of stripped all of that away. And, you know, suddenly you find yourself spending 8 or 10 hours a day in front of a computer. You know, you kind of lose some of that. So, as I said, I was very early on at college, I'd got very interested in printmaking and silkscreen printing. And I just wanted to reconnect with that, really, just get, you know, much more creative with my work, get, you know, ink under my fingers. And so came down here without a job, without knowing anybody, rocked up in this strange rocky landscape in West Penwith, where I've known and been coming to for a long time, for most of my life, since I was a child. So I have very happy memories of this place. So so started printmaking, just an expression, an outlet, you know, for me personally. And through that started to do quite well, through a network of sort of friends and artists down here. I got invited along to give a few talks at Falmouth University, which went quite well. They must have quite liked me. They kept asking me back. And eventually, a couple of years ago, I became an associate lecturer, and this year a full-time lecturer in the third year illustration degree course, with a bit on the photography, fashion photography MA as well, which is interesting. So, but most of my teaching is to students in their third years, especially this semester when we're gearing them up and getting them ready to go out into the world, you know, what it's actually like to transition across from higher education, where you've spent 3 years experimenting and learning and being creative and being quite expansive. But how you kind of refocus, how you build a portfolio, your social media websites, how you get your work out into the world, how you get in front of art directors, agency bosses, publishers, what that work looks like, what it says about you, and when you do start getting work, how do you take a brief? How do you respond to a brief? How do you be a professional? You know, so having spent best part of 30 years commissioning photography and illustration, all of the tutors there are brilliant and they're great and they're diverse and they all come from different backgrounds. But what they didn't have was someone the other side of the fence, you know, someone who sat on the commissioning side, looking for new talent, looking for young students, you know, as well as, you know, existing talent as well. And what I look for, what it is that makes it special, what is it about someone's work that makes me think, yeah, they're the person, that's interesting. That's something I've not seen. That's something that gets me engaged. That's something I think I can use and will work. So that's really my role at the uni, is a kind of professional practice aspect, to really get students. And I think that's a real strength of the Falmouth course. I know I know my eldest daughter graduated in illustration from LCC, and it was incredibly inspiring and creative. But I'm not sure I could have given a single one of them a job because I didn't know actually what they did. I mean, it was Falmouth is very, very strong on this, on professional practice. They have a whole element of the course where they build a dossier, which is about industry and work practices. And, it's from that perspective, it's quite a good fit. And then there's just my, sort of professional, my design work still, in the background, there's still design work going on and bits and pieces of freelance work, nice jobs that which is nice because it means I can just pick and choose and stuff I'm interested in now.
And just to go back slightly, so just in terms of this issue of having the professional lie based on, say a long career with some really, really interesting organizations and brands and businesses, etc. So just talk us through then. So I mentioned it very briefly earlier on about looking at your site right now in front of me. Some beautiful stuff on there. So just talk us through. So once you jumped out of agency world and then went off to work for some really high profile magazines, just talk about that. So made the switch and some of the people that you worked with.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was, I've always been a kind of a magazine junkie, I think it's hard to imagine, but sort of growing up in the 70s, there really wasn't any media, certainly not media particularly targeted at young people and teenagers, and then it wasn't until 1980, when suddenly you had, Nick Logan launched The Face, Terry Jones launched ID, and these were magazines that were very much, about music, about street culture and fashion, particularly targeted and aimed at, a younger demographic. And from then in, I was kind of hooked on magazines. I've always been a big fan of typography as well, going back to those punk sleeves, the typography, referring back to De Stijl and Dadaism and their use of sort of found type in collages and stuff. So I'd become more and more interested in magazines. So when I got the opportunity to launch a new magazine at The Observer with Michael Pilgrim as the editor, who was the editor on Record Mirror, which was the magazine I'd been on before I was in my agency work. So, and we were kind of pretty much left alone. We were given a sort of an office in a side building and got on and left to get on with launching this magazine. And so we didn't have much budget. Newspapers didn't for kind of photography and whatever, generally speaking. So, initially, when we started doing fashion for The Observer, Life magazine, we were working with some really young up and coming and edgy fashion designers, people like Dave Sims, and Glenn Lutchford, people like that, who went on to have fantastic, Glenn is a really old friend of mine from Brighton anyway, but now shoots all, lives in New York and very successful career in shooting all of Gucci's campaigns and all their TV campaigns and stuff, and people, sadly Corinne Day, is no longer with us. That was genuinely exciting. They were young people with not much experience. We didn't have budgets, but it allowed them to be really creative, and we gave them the space to be creative. And I think it was quite unusual that we were allowed to be given the space to be that creative in that area. So that was a sort of very exciting period. And it was the same with the journalists. I mean, Michael Pilgrim, the editor, was very good. We got lots of young writers and journalists as well, up and coming, and let them loose on the world, who've gone, people like Miranda Sawyer, we got Will Self to do restaurant reviews of chip shops in Blackpool, and we would send an illustrator. We had a brilliant illustrator called Chris Price, who was bonkers. We used to send him with Will Self on trips to like chip shops in the north of England, and he would actually sit and draw, brilliant, in the chip shop, things like that. I always kind of try and, in my editorial work, is try and be surprising, try and have some fun, be witty. I think there's quite often a lack of humor, a lack of wit, especially when I moved across into more, the FT, How to Spend It, into sort of high fashion and style. I think a lot of the problem with a lot of high-end fashion and style, lifestyle stuff, is has a real lack of humor and a lack of wit. And I think that's something I've always tried to keep with me in my work and in the people I work with and collaborate with, which is quite interesting. So after The Observer, I guess I shouldn't mention the sort of 6 or 7 years I spent at the Daily Mail, which was, I think we can just write that one off, frankly. Moving swiftly on. I paid the mortgage for a few years. That's all I can say. And I'll sort of draw a line under that. But it's an object lesson again to my students. Don't follow the money. You know, I went there because they offered me, you know, for the time, a very, you know, considerable sum of money. And it was the most miserable period in my life, creatively stilting. And yeah, so that's something as a takeaway, I would definitely advise against. And then I think, you know, my next three jobs, I think I took big pay cuts. I went the wrong way. I was a bit like the sort of Orson Welles of graphic design. I just kind of kept taking less and less money to do more and more interesting jobs, you know. So, but how to spend it, you know, again, that was something, you know, when I started at the FT, you know, how to spend it. It was doing 12 issues a year and one fashion special. I think when I left, they were doing 24 issues a year. They were doing sort of boating specials and watch specials and fashion specials and interior specials and Christmas specials. So, I mean, it was a bit like a money printing machine, if I'm honest. But there, you know, what was great was I did get to work with some fantastic photographers, people like Uli Weber and Rick Guest, you know, people that really were top at the games and really creative and interesting people to work with. So I learned a lot there. But again, I think... I, you know, it's something you get bored of quite quickly, I think. I probably stayed there a little bit too long. I mean, I there's only so much you can do with luxury, and I started to feel a little bit uncomfortable with it, especially sort of post, you know, the big global crash, you know, working for a magazine called How to Spend It. You know, it did have, you know, I kind of, you know, personally, I began to feel quite uncomfortable with that in some ways. So moving on to Intelligent Life, The Economist, which was their long form journalism and culture magazine, not the main Economist. But that felt much more, you know, that was much more my sweet spot in terms of editorial content. You know, really, really interesting writers, you know, Robert McFarlane, people like that. Long form journalism, 7,000-8,000 word pieces. I mean, we still did style, we still did travel, but we did them in kind of interesting ways, you know, and coming up with interesting visual solutions to that, you know, through photography or illustration. You know, for me, collaboration has always been the real creative driving force in what I do, is just working with really great people, you know, whether that's writers, whether it's photographers, whether it's illustrators, you know. And that's the thing, you know, that I kind of miss the most, I guess, in not doing a magazine regularly anymore, is having, you know, that kind of that contact with that creative world and just going out and working with people and finding new talent and sort of, you know, working with those people to create, you know, interesting and striking visual solutions and engaging visual solutions. So,
That's the same. I'm looking at, I've got the site up on my screen at the moment. So looking at, in terms of Intelligent Life, beautiful work. One of them got, which obviously is a lot of stuff taken from presumably the original shoot for Heroes, the Bowie stuff. And
yeah,
some great stuff for Orwell.
The Bowie cover was really interesting, actually, because, you know, we were doing all the usual research, and, you know, it's another great thing to be able to do, you know, spend a couple of weeks, because it was bi-monthly rather than monthly or weekly. You really had time to kind of invest in ideas and research and background and really develop, you know, strong ideas. So, you know, it occurred to me going back through all of the Bowie back catalogues of all the images, you know, just trying to find something. You know, we couldn't get a shoot with him, unfortunately. That would have been my dream. I think he's the one person I haven't shot that I would really have loved to. But, you know, I couldn't really find anything that wasn't, you know, that didn't feel like it had been seen before, trying to uncover something new. And then Mel, who's our picture editor, brilliant, brilliant picture editor on Intelligent Life, managed to track down the photographer, the Japanese, so his name escapes me, which is terrible, and managed to get him to send over some contact sheets from that hero shoot. And it's amazing, actually. I mean, if you, to look through, it's a shame, because if you could see the rest of the shoot and all the outtakes, you can see Bowie goofing around, pulling faces, gurning. You know, it's really quite weird. So you see the cover of Heroes and you think, here's this ultra serious, you know, person, you know, very deep and very moody. And it's kind of off to one side, it's black and white, grainy. And you get a certain feeling from what it must have been like, and the shoot was nothing like it. You know, it literally, you can see him pulling funny faces and, you know, going cross-eyed, sticking his tongue out, you know. And I thought that was fascinating. I just think it's really weird, and that's an interesting thing all of the reader ever gets to see, or the consumer, the purchaser, is that final, you know, moment, that final shot, that final front cover of the magazine or the album sleeve. But, you know, everything behind that has got a story and a narrative to it, which is really interesting. And I think it's a shame that people don't get to see more of that, because it can be very telling. So anyway, what I quite liked with that cover was you look at it and you think it's the same shot as a cover of Heroes, and it actually isn't. It's a kind of, it's an outtake, you know, it's a separate shot, you know, but there's that moment of recognition, and then there's that kind of, oh, hang on, no, that's not quite the image I thought it was, you know. So that was good fun.
Can I just say, actually, just you mentioned the Japanese photographer. As you were talking, I quickly looked at it. So Masayoshi Sakita.
Yes, that's it.
And
yes, yes.
Brilliant, a great bit of trivia was that when he, on that shoot, Iggy Pop just happened to sort of turn up. So he then just like banged a couple of shots off, as they say.
Oh, really? Do you know, I didn't know that. That is very interesting. Yes, that's very good.
Fantastic.
Well, there you go. Another bit of backstory that I didn't know. I mean, I think those little narratives, those little stories, as I say, I think are very engaging. And I, you know, it's a lot to be mined from those, I think.
And then the complete sort of side issue, but then I know it's a real sort of passion of yours, as I say, in real life and also just straight through a design. So the cover there, Ruler magazine.
Ruler. I kind of, one of the things when I, again, first moved to Cornwall, I didn't really work for a year. It took me quite a long time to sort of decompress and recover from London and city life and all of, you know, the media stuff, you know. So I kind of, all I did really for about a year was ride my bike. every little sort of byway and bridleway and road in sort of southwest Cornwall I kind of know intimately now. But I did know a couple of the guys over at Ruler, the editor there, and I did say, you know, was, you know, one of, on my tick list, it's a particularly fine magazine that I really admired, the photography, the ethos, the design, the type, you know. I just got a call one day to say, do you want to do a bit of sort of guest art direction? You know, Rob, our art director, is off having a baby, or rather his partner is. So I spent a fabulous kind of couple of weeks up in London in their offices, mostly watching the Tour de France. And in between time, you know, just again, they've got some brilliant photographers. You know, what's very difficult with a magazine like that, and what's a challenge for an art director, is, you know, how do you basically take the same stories, the same races, the same people, and the history, and reinvent that? How do you constantly update that? How do you make it feel fresh for a new audience? How do you sort of still engage people, you know? And I think they did it very, very well. You know, they're very good at it. And they're still very good at it. I just got the 100th edition through the post with some nice sort of gold foil type on the cover and stuff. So, but again, that mixture of working with sort of young and not so young, experienced, talented photographers on the commissioning side, mixed with some really great historical research and looking through old sports libraries, old pictures of, you know, Eddie Merckx and, you know, all the greats from the sports history, you know. So it was a really fun project that I really enjoyed, and really I'd like to do that again if anyone's out there listening. I haven't done that for a while, so that'd be another one I'd jump at like a shot. But I am a real magazine junkie, and it's quite good to see. I think there's a real resurgence in magazine publishing at the moment. I mean, because it's become so much cheaper to create magazines. I think if you look at, you know, Jeremy Leslie's got a very, very good podcast and Instagram feed called Mag Culture, and he does lots of speaking, but he's also got a magazine shop, you know, and magazine in Brighton. There's another small independent magazine shop, and I could just spend hours and hours and hours in there. I mean, there are so many great magazines being put together by small teams of people who are just passionate about particular issues and subjects, you know, whatever that might be, history, politics, travel, fashion, you know, arts. And I think it's a real burgeoning market, and there's a huge amount of creativity going on in there. So again, for like creatives kind of coming out of university now, whether they're graphic designers or art directors or illustrators or photographers, you know, there's a huge amount of scope there in that area. That part of the media is having a real resurgence, I think. I think people are coming back to physicality, you know, paper, smell of ink. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for that, which you can't ever really replicate in a digital space. You know, I mean, there's a lot of creativity, obviously, in the digital space, and there's some amazing things going on. But I don't know. I think, you know, that kind of paper turning, something that sits with you, something you can keep that's a physical object, you know, it's more sort of fetishistic, I think. And you can collect them and you can put them on your bookshelves. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for that. So, yeah. Mm.
Just as a slight aside, I mean, you mentioned the whole thing about, you know, moving down to Cornwall and essentially not working for a year, just sort of reconnecting and all the rest of it. And then I know you're sort of very obsessed, to put it mildly, with the world of cycling. So just because most of the listeners to this podcast are actually in the States and may not be overly familiar with Cornwall.
Right, yes.
Go on then. Just so, as in if someone was now talking and describing, I don't know, Portland and Oregon or something for someone who's never been there. So go on then, just talk us through one of your epic rides, whatever, in deepest Cornwall.
Crikey. Okay. Yeah. I mean, well, basically, I mean, where I'm living is about as close to America as you can get in the UK. I'm at a couple of miles from Land's End, which possibly, you know, American listeners may know. So, which is a very sort of wet, windy, cold, dark place for most of the time. But in between that, it has flashes of astonishing light and sunshine. So, I mean, a typical ride for 3 or 4 hours, if I'm doing a sort of, you know, sort of 70, 80, 90 mile ride, that can include beaches and sand and landscape. It can, like, deep valleys. I mean, it's very warm and mild, so we've got sort of subtropical valleys with palm trees growing. We've got high rocky moorland, you know, granite. So I mean, any one ride, you know, I'll go through sort of, you know, the whole gamut of and the one thing we don't really have is a lot of trees. There's not a lot of forest goes on down here because of the wind, so there's not a lot of sort of forest tracks and forest trails like you might get up in Portland, Oregon, and up around there, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's a stunning, stunning landscape. And it's something which is, you know, one of the reasons I'm here, you know. I mean, there's a real kind of physical connection to the landscape. It's what drew most of the, you know, the St. Ives School of artists and painters down here, you know, from the Barbara Hepworths and, you know, Terry Frost and all of those people, was the quality of the light down here is just absolutely amazing. And the ruggedness and the physicality of the landscape, you know, and that informs a lot of my work. And it's, you know, it's possibly slightly cliched, but I think it's what draws a lot of people, especially artists, to this area. And there is a thriving arts community. But yeah, no, that's what an average bike ride. And of course, and a lot of surfing these days as well. So I'm trying to get better at surfing. It's not exactly California or Malibu Beach. You know, it's a lot colder and a lot windier and a lot gnarlier than that. But and it's incredibly difficult. I quite like doing difficult things, and it's a challenge. I'm sort of 2 or 3 years in and still pretty rubbish, but I should have started it about 30 years ago, I think, surfing, but I'm getting there slowly, you know. It's and being first thing in the morning, I mean, Sean, you know, Seddon Cove, the beach at Seddon Cove, being down there in the dawn as the sun's coming up, just in the water, you know, with sea lions and dolphins bobbing around and kind of terns and gannets plummeting into the sea all around you. I mean, it's a pretty special place to be, especially for someone that grew up in London, spent his whole life working and living in the city. I mean, it's quite a revelation, really. I mean, a real kind of mind-altering experience. You know, it took me a very long time even to be able to sleep because I couldn't get over the lack of light and the lack of noise. I mean, it was just having, you know, being right in the middle of Brighton and the bright lights and big city. I mean, that alone was quite a weird shift, you know.
You mentioned there, by the way, the issue of sort of St. Ives and the art scene, etc. So just in terms of art in general, creativity in general, if I can put it as crudely as that, so what's inspiring you at the moment? Any particular artists or bands out there or things going on that you are really sort of sparking your interest?
Yeah, well, I do slightly worry that I'm a bit of a kind of cultural dilettante, really. I mean, I just kind of, the one thing, I just don't seem to have enough time in my life to kind of explore everything I'd really like to. I mean, I'm always looking for new printmakers, you know, because I'm interested in print. You know, I'm really interested in looking at people who push the boundaries of kind of the use of media. So there's I've just got a print actually, which has just turned up. I thought it'd gone missing in the sort of COVID rush of post. But Kari Christensen, who's a fantastic lino printer in Canada, does the most amazing architectural linear black and white lino prints and uses lino in a way that, you know, is completely revolutionary, completely different to any kind of lino printing I've seen before. Paul Catherall is another great, again, he happens to be a lino artist, but his work looks very much like silkscreen print work. So, I mean, I'm constantly sort of being inspired, you know, but I'm constantly finding new people. I mean, I'm still very much rooted in kind of mid-century modern, you know, 50s, 60s, in terms of art, you know, the abstract expressionism of Eve Klein, Rothko, Morris Lewis, all that kind of thing. I've got more into sort of installation art as well and conceptual art. I mean, recent exhibitions by Ai Weiwei and Ella Natsui, you know, I've just been blowing me away, really. So, I mean, my daughter is a kind of managing editor of a young, quite sort of hip, edgy art magazine called Elephant. So she keeps me very up to date. Yeah. Lots of all the kind of new stuff that's going on at the sort of cutting edge of the art world, you know, some of which is for me and some of which isn't, you know, but that's quite interesting. But yeah, I mean, all of the St. Ives School, you know, as I say, Barbara Hepworth and Ben Nicholson. But even when you think you know artists, I came across an old book. There's a really good arts bookshop in Penzance. I found an old catalogue of Wilhelmina Barnes Graham print work from the 70s, which I'd never come across before, which was really inspiring, which I loved. Music, as you know, I'm really, you know, still currently, you know, always looking for new music. I mean, I've always been quite a sort of, well, very, very broad in my sort of musical taste. I mean, there's almost no genre of music I don't find interesting in one way or another, as you know. But I'm really liking kind of some of the new Jazztronica stuff that's coming out at the moment. You know, the Kamasi Washington, Ezra Collective, the Michael Kiwanuka album has just, you know, been listening to constantly. But also, you know, I listen to a lot of electronica at the moment, sort of Floating Points, John Hopkins, you know, Fortet. And again, I've always been interested in that kind of electronica from sort of Eno Bowie period, you know, through to the Orb and Aphex Twin and stuff. And that kind of classical crossover, you know, the Nils Frams and the Max Richters and whatever. And then old favourites, you know, Nick Cave's Ghosteen album again is one. I've been going to see Nick Cave for about 40 years now, I realised. I first saw The Birthday Party when I was about 16 or 17 at the Africa Centre in London. And yeah, I've been watching him in his various incarnations, you know, for the best part of 40 years. And the energy of the guy and the imagination. And I just think he's a fantastic artist. Yeah. And then, you know, those old usuals, you know, that you carry with you. You know, they say you're a product of your generation, you know, but obviously the fact that I can still listen to Weller and Bowie and, you know, I mean, is constantly there in the background. Mm. But then, you know, they're also always, as I said, a magazine junkie as well, and a bit of a typo junkie. So I've got some new, there's a new crowdfunded typographic magazine called Type One that I've just got through the post this week, which is keeping me happy. People of Print is a good organization that works with a lot of artists, people like Shepherd Fairey, you know, they do fold out kind of poster zines, which are really interesting, sort of double-sided A2 posters, which I'm really liking, which are divided up with little narratives, little stories and things, which is great. So those are some of the things that, you know, have been keeping me going during lockdown over here, you know.
Very nice. I think we're talking about sort of epic typography. I think it was you that actually got me into the wonderful Raygun magazine back in
David Carson. Cool. I mean, I think, David Carson was a brilliant example of someone who had no formal training. He was a professional surfer, you know, and
I didn't know.
No, that's how he started off. He started on Surfer magazine. And again, you know, I think there was a lot of energy, you know, about the 80s growing up in that period. If you look at Neville Brody and The Face, when you look ID, and then a bit after that in the, you know, sort of in the 90s when Raygun came along after Surfer magazine with David Carson, and that kind of when Type and Tomato, John Warwicker, and Underworld, all of that kind of thing as well, where they were using type as a sort of, as imagery in its own right. Again, looking back to and referencing, all of those art movements from the 20s and 30s and 40s, and using type in a really expressive way. I find that really interesting and really exciting. So, he was someone definitely that was very inspirational in a lot of my work as well.
And then talk us about fine art. So in terms of your prints, because I mean, again, I'm looking at those now, and I think I last saw them when I was down actually in Cornwall a year or so ago, when one was allowed to actually sort of be down there and in the beautiful surroundings of Tremenier Sculpture Gardens. But talk about your pebble prints and tree and abstract prints, because
I mean, that, again, as I say, I think it was I'd got very interested in silkscreen printing, back at art college, and but that was all very much rooted. I mean, historically, silkscreen printing has been, it was a cheap way of disseminating information. It was for agitprop. It was the sort of thing if you were doing a club flyer, or a poster, or for in political movements and stuff. Knocking out a cheap silkscreen print with a mechanical photograph, a dot screen photo and some. Some bold type was the way to get across those messages. I think that, that's largely been subsumed by digital media. It's now so cheap and so easy to create, a poster, even sort of imitating silkscreen, is quite a straightforward and easy thing to do. But it is different. You don't get that kind of physicality. You don't get that sense of kind of the artist's hand, or, that kind of expression. And what I really wanted to do when I came down here was kind of, again, I said I'm sort of interested in sort of pushing use of media. So all of my process with silkscreen work is, I mean, A, it's rooted in the landscape, as you know. I mean, down at the beach at Senon, those huge, huge oversized boulder granites, which are kind of half submerged in the sand, or they're sort of half submerged under the water, a bit like an iceberg. So I'm quite interested in those kind of horizon lines and what you can see and what you can't see. And that informs a lot of my work. So I'm constantly out sketching, drawing, just kind of go out with a, little notebook and constantly sort of scribbling away. But rooted in the abstraction of kind of, 50s abstract expressionism, So the texture of the granite, the color, I mean, the color is the other thing, the gorse down here, really vibrant yellows, the beach, the light. So, I mean, when I first moved down, my work was quite gray, quite dark, quite monochromatic. And it was interesting, someone pointed out to me after a couple of years of being down here, when I did open studios down here, people were coming in and saying, wow, I just love your use of color, those bright pops of red and the oranges and the yellows. And it was something that had sort of subliminally crept into my work, not really a conscious decision. But the shapes of those abstract forms. I mean, every time I'm out on my bike as well, with the trees, we have these things called Monterey pines, which were introduced at the turn of last century. From California originally, obviously being called Monterey pines, but become so windswept by the winds down here, the Atlantic kind of storms, that they're very much distorted and twisted. And I couldn't work out what it is that I was drawn to them so much by. And then I realized, if you go back and look at some of those Yes triple albums by Roger Dean in the 70s, that's exactly what he was drawing. Those rocks, I think if you reference them, I mean, it might be deeply unfashionable, or maybe it's very deeply fashionable again now. I'm not quite sure. I'm a little bit out of touch on that. I have a few students that have been referencing his work recently, so maybe that's kind of on its way back. But suddenly I made that connection. So when I'm out on my bike, when I'm cycling around and I come across a new tree that I've not seen before, I'll just whip out my my iPhone, take a snap, and then I'll go back and revisit it with my good camera, with my sort of high-res digital camera, take some shots, make some screens. And that's kind of referencing my love of sort of Japanese printmaking and woodblock printing as well. So that's kind of looping back to, again, another thing I'm sort of deeply interested in is that woodblock woodblock Japanese printmaking as well. So they're sort of definitely, you know, those are the kind of influences, you know, the landscape, you know, abstract expressionism, Japanese woodblock printing. And you kind of filter those and, you know, and create from that your own sort of visual language. And I think that's what I kind of teach, you know, or try and instill in the students at uni, you know, is developing that unique visual language, that kind of personal aesthetic that, you know, every, you know, the only thing you've got really is yourself, and you're the thing that's different to everybody else. And I think if that's what you need to draw out of yourself, you know, as a creative visual person, you know, you've got to have your unique take on the world and your use of media, you know, use of composition, color, whatever it might be, you know, but what is it that makes you different from everybody else out there? And I think that's a personal journey for everybody in a creative sense.
Yeah, very much so. Well, I mean, as we begin to finish off, and it's been so interesting, Graham, so thanks for giving me your time. So in terms of what you're actually up to right now, and then also what's coming up for you, I mean, here we are sort of, you know, early 21. I mean, presumably the students have are taking a lot of your time in terms of what they're up to at Falmouth and elsewhere. So, yeah, go on then, talk us through...
Okay, well, yeah, no, clearly, I mean, usually, I mean, I think secretly one of the reasons they got me into Falmouth, they do this fantastic publication every year called the Wonder Kammer, which is a cabinet of curiosities. And it was basically a sort of a student and alumni kind of publication every year. And I took that on last year for the first time from Karen Bibby, who's the head of course there. So because of my sort of background in magazine and publishing and editorial, I kind of got heavily involved with that. So we're doing it again this year, but sadly we can't do a print version. That's not going to happen. So we're working out how to do that digitally and online. So they're at the end of a project at the moment where they create a piece of promotional work for that. So they're on a deadline for that. And then we're going to be working out, you know, how that exists in the digital space, in, you know, the online space. So that's the big project that's ongoing for the next few weeks. And then looking forward to them building, you know, their own websites and putting together their own portfolios and stuff. So that's a busy period for them over the next kind of few weeks or so. Personally, I'm very excited to be working on a new book with a fantastic photographer called James Diamond, who used to be a big fashion photographer and much more of a fine art photographer now. He's a photographer in residence at the Genome Damage Center in the School of Life Sciences at Sussex Uni. And his background's in physics, which is really, he does amazing work. So I'm working with him on producing a big sort of coffee table book of his new projects over the next few months as well, which I'm really looking forward to seeing. That's going to kind of, and my own sort of personal print work as well, obviously kind of is going on in the background. I never seem to carve out enough time to do that. So any gaps get plugged, you know, by getting in the print room and getting inky and dirty there. But I'm really looking forward to sort of being able to get out to exhibitions. I'm very lucky just before the last lockdown to once again see the awesome Grayson Perry exhibition, Vanity of Small Differences, was showing at the Newnan Exchange, which is a fantastic body of work, you know, on British society and taste and all of that. And I've seen it a few times before, and every time I go and see it, I see more in it. So that was great. So, but those are the things in terms of personal work and, you know, what I'll be up to over the next you'd see me through the rest of lockdown, hopefully. So that's what's going to be going on.
And so, that you mentioned the Newlyn Exchange there, what a lovely location. Now you mentioned, by the way, the whole thing about books. Also should mention in terms of the books you've done, so looking at now, so Authors on Museums, and also the one about Barcelona.
That was great. Yeah, no, I mean, Mike Diver and Pedro Aguilar, you know, were two, they were a collaborative duo I used to work with a lot at, when I was at How to Spend It, and a bit at Intelligent Life as well. They both had a fine art background. They were both fantastic, you know, creative powerhouse, the two of them. But they managed to do Pedro, obviously being Spanish, they had links. They did a lot of agency work and a lot of advertising photography, and they did a lot of work with Barcelona FC, and got amazing access to them for a whole season, sort of behind the scenes and going to the Champions League Cup final in the end and winning that. So, and they documented that for a whole year. So I worked with them on putting that book together, which was absolutely fantastic. I mean, but, you know, getting a real bird's eye view behind the scenes kind of look at everything that went on, but you know, behind the, you know, the training and everything, and the stars and the fandom and the marketing, the advertising, you know, the energy, all around, you know, a global football team like that. So that was really good fun. That was great. I loved working on that as well. I seem to have somehow managed to do quite a lot of sort of sports stuff, which I hadn't really kind of reflected on before. But yeah, it's but they did a lot of really, really amazing work, really creative in the early days of sort of digital as well, and exploring that and pushing the boundaries of that. So that was great. Another guy was Rick Guest. I mean, Rick Guest is another fantastic photographer I had the pleasure of working with, who started off, he does a lot of does quite a bit of sports work, you know, in the commercial world for sort of big clients, Adidas and Nike and stuff. But he also does an amazing body of work with the Royal Ballet, which started off with us doing some shots with, I don't know if you know Ed Watson, who's one of the star dancers at the Royal Ballet. And we did a few projects with him, and Rick's put together about two or three books now, working very closely with all the dancers at the Royal Ballet, which the physicality of which is just, you know, absolutely amazing. So you know, and that was something again I just keep coming back to. I think when we're looking, I know you're sort of keen to sort of think about you know, the key views and the ethos of this podcast, you know, New Abnormal, you know, hope, community and resilience, you know. And yeah, I just think, you know, I think it's good, you know, most of my life, you know, I've you know, been driven by collaboration and working with other people and bouncing off of other people. And I think, you know, moving forward, I think that's going to be something that's ever more a strength of people, a sort of coming together. I think what people, you know, it seems a bit cliche, but, you know, that quote, Joni Mitchell, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And I think suddenly the one thing coming out of this whole COVID lockdown thing is how much people miss other people. And looking at people on a screen, chatting to people, you know, via Zoom links and Teams and whatever, is not the same as being able to kind of, you know, embrace someone, hold their hands, hug them, you know, talk to them, you know, that kind of physicality. And I think, you know, the support in the community for people has been amazing. And people's response, the human response to this has been amazing, you know, within, you know, frontline workers, the NHS, people coming out to clap and show their support for all of that. I mean, I was thinking about it. We sort of glossed over sort of the 80s and Thatcher's Britain and stuff, which was a kind of deeply dark and dangerous and soulless and violent kind of period, I think, in British society. And I was kind of thinking back, and I remembering, you know, that and it made me wonder whether, you know, coming out of COVID, you know, I think as a takeaway from this, something I've been sort of pondering quite a lot, is whether, you know, whether post COVID, whether it's finally going to be the death knell, you know, that dogma of Thatcher of there's no thing as society. As far as I'm concerned, society is all we have. You know, other people, our links with each other, you know, that kind of selfishness and that inward looking after number one. I think we've had 40 years, we've been kind of suffering from that. And it makes me wonder, you know, you talk about hope, you talk about community, you talk about resilience. I think these are all great things. And I'm really hopeful that, you know, if there's one good thing that can sort of be salvaged from the whole kind of global pandemic, is people's realization that all we've got is each other, you know. And I think that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. Oh, nicely put, Graham. Wow, fantastic. Okay, then. So literally, as a final thing then, just so the listeners can know where they can track you down. Go on then. So where are you on the internet and in the social media, etc.?
Okay. Well, anyone that, you know, had any sort of mild interest in my print work, largely I do it for myself. And if anyone else is interested, that's great, you know. But I'm on at Graham Black Prints on Instagram, and it's grahamblackprints.myportfolio.com is my sort of print website, and then sort of professional work, magazines, editorial art direction. That's kind of at Bureau Black, but that's with an X, so BUREAUXBLACK. And the same the website, so it's bureaublack.co.uk for the website. So that's where I'm at, that's what I'm doing, and if I'm not out cycling or surfing, you know, you might catch me. So
very nice too. Well, in that case, all I can say is that Graham Black, the owner and creative director at Bureau Black Design and lecturer at Falmouth University, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure. Yeah, I hope it was of at least some mild interest there. Thanks.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Graham. Cheers. Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating. Tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.